The following is a presentation of Podjockey.
And joining us now on the program is Alex Berenson. His latest is 12 Days. Ex-CIA agent John Wells, of course, is his hero. And this is one of the series. And Alex, first question. John Wells is a follower of Islam, and obviously you are very, very aware of everything that's going on in this country and the things that happened in North Carolina with the Muslim students. What went into your decision to make John Wells a follower, a Muslim?
So the Wells books have been around now for almost 10 years. It's hard for me to believe that, but it's true. And he's been Muslim really ever since the first book, The Faithful Spy. And he converts when he's undercover in Afghanistan and Pakistan, sort of in the years both before and after 9/11. And the reason he converts ultimately is he both to survive because, you know, the men he's with are all jihadis and want, you know, they want him to convert, they want him to become Muslim. But there's more to it than that for him. He does find some comfort in the brotherhood, you know, of the faith, and he also, you know, he needs to reach out to these men who he's fighting with in some way. And as he says to someone, you know, I believe it's in 12 Days, he says, "I had to take their ideology or their faith, and I wasn't going to take their ideology. I was not going to take the anti-American ideology of Al-Qaeda, so I took the faith instead."
As an author, though, that choice, in a way, are you saying, you know what, people wake up to the fact that even though Muslims are vilified, that here's a guy working on our side for our interest, and it's not an indictment of the religion, it's an indictment of radicals? Is that part of the message you're sending?
Absolutely. We will never defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS if we tar all Muslims with this brush, or even most Muslims. I mean, it seems strange to have to say this, but we do need to say it. Most Muslims don't support beheading people on camera. They don't support the use of the Quran to justify that kind of violence, and they're disgusted by what they see. That doesn't mean they always agree with the United States. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's not fundamental and legitimate discussions that we should be having. But John Wells, you know, in some ways he embodies this fact that we all need to keep in mind, which is that Islam is a faith with a broad range of interpretations and a broad range of belief, and the people who are speaking the most loudly for it don't necessarily represent the majority.
And as the president pointed out the other day, Christianity has its share of with the Crusades and everything else. So this is not just something that's endemic to a certain religion.
It's not. I would say I would disagree in one way on that. I mean, the Crusades did happen, but I don't think we should use something that happened 500 or 1,000 years ago to justify in any way the behavior that we're seeing now from from radical Muslims. I mean, Christianity went through a reformation, and that's real. Part of it, one of the things that frustrates me about this is that for all you and I and every other non-Muslim discusses this, on some level this has to come from inside Islam. And it does worry me a little bit that I'm not sure who inside Islam can lead that, because there's no equivalent of the Catholic Church, really.
Well, in your book, one of your characters, and one of the villains actually, kind of says, look, Sunnis and the Shias can't get along, they're killing each other, that what can we actually do from the outside to keep that stuff from happening, that it's maybe beyond our power?
That is a real problem. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, right? We should try to encourage progressive Islam. We should try to encourage these regimes to allow dissent, to allow, you know, to allow voices to speak out who might not, who, if they're not allowed to speak out, might be forced or feel they're being forced into this radical jihad.
Now, one of the first parts of your book involves a plane that is downed, and, you grab the reader instantly because you describe this pilot who's just a very admirable guy, formerly was a Navy pilot, and you really like him. And then just a few pages later, and I'm not giving you spoilers here because it's in the first chapter, the plane is hit and he's gone. Tell us a little bit about, you know, getting us to like that character so much, and then all of a sudden, that's it.
Well, terrorism takes people who we do like, you know, and it takes the innocent, in real life, there are no guarantees that you're going to survive, and there's no guarantees that, you know, the people who went to the Trade Center on 9/11 had no idea that that was going to happen to them, and most of those people were just good, average, everyday people, and they went to work one day and they died, and that's what terrorism is. So, you know, if I'm capturing that in the book, and you're saying to yourself, no, this guy's not actually going to get blown up on this plane. He's going to maneuver the plane out. He's a former pilot. This is going to work for him. You know, and then it doesn't. And then he dies. And unfortunately, that's the reality. I mean, Kayla Mueller should not have been killed. That shouldn't have happened to her. She was essentially an innocent, naive soul who got captured by these, you know, these incredibly psychopathic jihadis, and all the goodwill in the world could not free her. Her family's pleas could not free her. And unfortunately, I need to capture some of that in the book. Sometimes the good die too.
Well, that I think speaks to your skill as a writer, because you could have easily had 200 and some anonymous people on the plane, and it's a number. But you've humanized it with the character who was visiting his homeland for the first time and the pilot. So when it did happen, you really felt it, as opposed to, oh, it's 278 people.
Yes. I mean, those are, you know, there's the line that pilots use is, you know, 278 human souls. And that's who they are. It is not just a number. If ISIS has done one good thing, it is reminding us that the victims who they're killing are real people, and putting these people on camera. I would not wish it on my worst enemy, but it is at least a reminder that of who's being hurt here.
Now, the bigger issue here is Iran and the nuclear program, and you deal with that. But it's interesting, you've kind of taken it from the headlines, in that there are people who are actively against trying to come to a settlement or an agreement, and basically say that you can't trust Iran, and no matter what they do, they'll surreptitiously keep enriching uranium and come up with a bomb. Very difficult issue, and I'm interested in your feelings about it.
Well, I think, you know, in the book, in 12 Days, people keep saying to John Wells, you know, what you're doing here is essentially helping Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And what he's saying is, I do know that, but ultimately the United States cannot invade Iran on false evidence, and probably shouldn't invade Iran at all. And that is the reality of the situation that we're facing right now. And and that's why I think this is going to get hotter and hotter over the next few weeks as we get closer to whatever deal it is we may or may not reach with Iran. Iran, it seems clear, wants a nuclear weapon. They can say whatever they like. Their actions for the last 15 years are the actions of a country that badly wants a nuclear weapon. And by the way, if they didn't want a nuclear weapon, these talks would be very easy. They would open everything up. They'd demand some kind of payment for it. We'd reach some agreement on what that payment would be, and the sanctions would be dropped. The reason that this is happening is not because Iran believes that it needs civilian nuclear power. It's a giant, you know, it's a giant oil state. The people at the top of Iran want a nuclear weapon. No one is going to convince me otherwise. So the game we're playing with Iran is, how far can we get you to back off to drop these sanctions? And the game, they, to me, ultimately have the stronger hand, because they've labored under these sanctions for years, and it seems that ultimately they'd be willing to continue to do that to get a bomb. At least there's enough people at the top of the Iranian military establishment and religious establishment, a bomb, that they'd be willing to do that. So we're in the weaker position here, and ultimately the talks are going to end with no resolution or with a resolution that may or may not be barely acceptable to people in Congress. And I think Netanyahu is concerned that the president is essentially going to try to force a resolution through Congress, or just say, I'm going to do this without Congress. I'm going to, you know, this is not a treaty. It doesn't need congressional approval. I can drop the sanctions on my own. And so, and Israel has even more to lose than we do if Iran gets a nuclear weapon.
So we look at this, though, as
a really, really tough spot here. I don't think there are any easy answers, but I do think that the president should not reach any agreement without going to Congress for approval. I think that this is too big a decision to be made by the executive alone.
See, I think the underlying assumption is that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that they will use it against Israel immediately or somewhere down the road because they've got it. Their viewpoint might be, well, you don't like Korea, but you haven't invaded North Korea. States that do have nuclear weapons, you're not going to come in. If Iraq had them, maybe you wouldn't have invaded. So is it possible that they're thinking this is a defensive weapon as opposed to, hey, the second we get it, there goes Israel?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think they absolutely view it that way. I don't think they intend to use it tomorrow, you know, or the day after they get it against Israel. The truth is that no state with a nuclear weapon has ever been invaded. And as you say, North Korea is still around, and Iraq and Libya, the heads of those regimes, wound up dead. And so if you're at the top of the Iranian establishment, you're very, very aware of that fact. But that doesn't mean the question ultimately we may have to decide is, can we live with a nuclear Iran? The unfortunate part of that is that the U.S. may be able to live with a nuclear Iran, and Israel may not. And that is a huge wedge between us. So if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it definitely makes them more dangerous. It means that they can, you know, meddle around in the Middle East even more than they do. It makes them more powerful. It possibly sets off a regional nuclear arms race with Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Those are all really bad things from the U.S. point of view. But it doesn't mean that the U.S. is an existential risk. Israel is an existential risk, and that is something that the Israelis may not feel that they can tolerate. So that's the gap, and that's why the book, I think, and hope, is as interesting, you know, politically as it is, because John Wells is an American, ultimately, and he doesn't want the United States to invade Iran on false evidence. But the guy who is funding this plot is a Jew who's married to an Israeli, and he feels that Israel's life is at stake here. And they both have really good points of view.
Yeah, and therein lies the maybe unsolvable conflict here, because the United States has the power to do this, and yet I don't think the American people have the will at this point, given Afghanistan and Iraq, to start something else, especially since, as you say, it's not existential for us, but for another country who is an ally. So if Israel decides that they have to do this on their own, that could be the likely answer.
But would they, could they do it on their own? Could they attack Iran on their own? Certainly they can't invade Iran on their own. Could they? Do they believe they have the air power to do this? I think that's something that's been debated in the Pentagon and in the Israeli Defense Forces for a while. And the answer seems to be no. That doesn't mean they wouldn't try. But what they would like is for the United States to commit to Iran is not going to get a nuclear weapon under any circumstances. That's what the result of these talks has to be. And they clearly feel that we're wavering on that. And that's why Netanyahu has, gone public the way he has. Now, whether or not that's a smart decision is yet another question. He seems to have made this a partisan fight in a way that is not working to his benefit.
That is true. Well, the book is fascinating. It examines all these issues that we've been talking about. You've got a great hero going here, and it's one of those books that, you start to read and you can't put it down because you draw the characters so well, and You take the villains, and I think I've told you this before, your villains aren't these mustache-twirling type guys. They have a valid point of view that is defensible, at least from their standpoint, as opposed to just being bad guys.
I mean, that's what makes this more than just a, you know, a dry dry history or some sort of political text. If you can both root for the good guy and understand the bad guys and, you know, want to turn the pages, then all I can say is I hope I've crafted that. That's what I try to do. Whether or not I succeed, it's really for the reader to judge.
Well, this reader thinks you have. Alex, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
Richard, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, Alex, thank you, and we'll talk again.
The proceeding has been a presentation of Podjockey. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved.